Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 852 redirects monies in the MUPL account to certain rural health care programs. It declares emergency and is effective July 1st, 2003. And on the line, we have Jeannie Bowden and Kathy Britton. They're in La Grande right now.
So we're going to start with an explanation of MUPL, right?
Mr. Chair, I'm John Britton from the Legislative Fiscal Office. How much would you like to know? Would you like the short version?
The short version.
The short version is that the Medicaid upper payment limit mechanism has been used in about the last two biennia. Certainly, we began it in the 99-01 or the 1999 legislative session. We discovered MUPL and worked on it, and it was used extensively in the current biennium, the 2001-03, to fund really three main things. We had about $333.6 million of MUPL. At least that's what we had planned on getting when we got out of the 2001 legislative session. We used that in the following ways. We had about $99 million budgeted in the K-12 education budget. About $101.3 million was going to the Oregon Health Sciences University. $15 million of that MUPL money was designated for the Oregon Rural Health Association. And finally, we were going to bank about $118.1 million. Now, over the course of the biennium, of course, we had problems with our budget, and that $118.1 million that was set aside was quickly used to fill holes and to replace general fund revenue that was being lost. So as of the fifth special session, we had budgeted about $250 million in the K-12 budget, $93 million, so that allocation went down to the Oregon Health Sciences University, $93.2 million, and the Oregon Rural Health Association, which had started at about $15 million, was then subsequently cut down to $3.75 million. And the overall amount that we had anticipated went up from $333 million to about $346 million. Since Special Session 5, we've learned that we probably will face a shortfall of about $11 million of the MUPL money, and that shortfall has not been yet allocated. So we don't know who's going to lose with respect to that $11 million. The mechanism, which I haven't really talked about, is a matter of using state general fund, matching it with federal dollars, and making a sizable payment to health districts, nine health districts. They turn that money around and make an intergovernmental transfer back to the state of Oregon. The general fund is returned to the programs from whence it came, and it's spent as other funds. The federal portion of the original payment has now become MUPL money and is placed in a MUPL account. The size of the payment is today based on the difference between the Medicaid upper limit, which is 100% of the Medicare rate for nursing facilities, versus what we pay in our Medicaid program for nursing facilities, multiplied times all the Medicaid beds, if you will, in the state. The federal government has indicated that it will no longer allow this kind of mechanism. Many states use it, and they have been in the process of phasing it out. Consequently, the $346 million, which represents MUPL payments made at the end of the 97-99 biennium, 99-01 and 01-03, All of that will now be more like $73.8 million for the upcoming biennium, and maybe $3 or $4 million after that. So that's a basic overview.
Okay. Any questions? Okay.
Just one.
Okay.
Mr.
Senator
Chair.
Walker.
Mr. Britton, there was some discussion in the newspaper several weeks ago about how we may have to pay back some of that money we used. Is that true?
Mr. Chair and Senator Walker, the Secretary of State conducted an audit of the entire Department of Human Services, particularly focusing on certain types of federal funds. This was one of the things that they audited. The Secretary of State indicated that they had questions about how the payments were done, especially in light of the federal rule changes that were going to phase this program out. Currently, the federal government is also looking at a number of states and the way that they use this mechanism. There is some disagreement, I would say, between the Secretary of State and the Department and the Attorney General about whether what the Department did was right or wrong or in balance, indifferent. Ultimately, the federal government will have to decide that, and we may owe some money back.
Move on, then.
In my estimation, and I'll go out on a limb here, I don't anticipate that we will owe a great deal of money back, if any.
And Mr. Chair,
yes.
We weren't the only state who was doing this funny business with the money, were we?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Walker, this was clearly within the law as far as Medicaid law was concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And no, we weren't the only state that was using the Medicaid upper payment limit by any means. In fact, the deluge of state plan amendments that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services received to enhance state budgets was precisely the reason that they closed the mechanism down or are in the process of phasing it out.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Chair.
Senator Fisher.
Yeah, it really wasn't the department, is my understanding. It was the legislature that actually made the changes and used the money as they saw fit rather than for the arena that it was planned for. I don't always stand up for the Human Resources Department, but I think in this case, I don't believe it was their fault.
Mr. Chair and Senator Fisher, the Assembly certainly knew what was going on there. We looked at it in the Legislative Fiscal Office. Everybody had a hand in this, so if there's blame to be spread or glory to be had, I think there's enough for everybody to participate in.
On a scale of 1 to 10, you wouldn't want to make a 10 being the most likely, you wouldn't want to hazard a guess as to the chances of us having to pay money back, would you?
Mr. Chair, absolutely not.
Okay, good. Mm-hmm. Good. Thank you. I didn't think so. Any further questions? Okay, seeing none. Thank you, John.
Okay, Mr. Chair, it won't be Lars Larson making that decision.
Oh, Lars Larson will make that decision.
Now we're in trouble.
Now we're in trouble. Okay.
I say it won't be.
Oh, it won't be. Okay. Senator Nelson, please come forward. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is David Nelson, State Senator from Pendleton. I represent four counties out there, Union, Wallowa, Umatilla, and Morrill counties, and I'm the sponsor of this bill, bringing it in. I guess the big thing is, as John has indicated to you, is that, you know, this is one-time money slot. It's a declining source of revenue. What I'm looking at is trying to provide some monies for rural health issues. The good thing about rural health things is that it doesn't take a lot of money to keep us happy out there. We're pretty inventive and resourceful, and we can take care of business. And so, you know, we're not talking hundreds of millions of dollars, maybe talking 20s to 30 millions of dollars. And so I'm looking at this, at the MUPL money coming in. I think the governor probably has in his budget dedicated education. I just feel like it's going to get thrown into the education budget and lost. This is some specific things that I think can be brought forth to you. If you look at the original bill, we had five categories, and there's been some discussion with interested parties in this bill, and so there's been some changes, and we do have some dash one, two, and three amendments, I think, coming in to address some of this. I don't know if you've got those yet. That's the problem.
No.
We're in the process. Can you have the dash ones?
Yeah, we don't have any.
Don't have any. Okay, well, there are three proposed amendments, and let me talk a little bit about those. And on the bill itself, we're talking section one on line 14, type A and type B hospitals. And there's some concern with the type of hospitals that they would rather their funding keep coming out of general fund and not rely upon MUPL money, which may as a declining source of revenue. And I'm entirely agreeable to taking that out of the bill. So I think that's the dash two amendments that we're talking about. And line 13, the one before, the percent of money going to the Office for Federally Certified Rural Health Clinics, there has been a request that we add on the not only rural health clinics but urban health clinics. And the difference, as I understand it, between federally qualified health clinics and the non-federally qualified health clinics is that basically it's administrative or paperwork. Folks in our part of the country, the rural part of the country, don't have the administrative processes available, so we don't qualify. We can't fill out the paperwork, basically. We don't have the staff to do that. But we're willing to include all the health clinics, and I think Ruby Houghton would testify to that particular issue. Going back to line 14, when we were talking about the A and B hospital, we leave that out.
Thank you. Thank you.
And what we're trying to get to on the amendment three, the DAS 3 amendments, is add in training for nurses on a statewide basis. Those would be the dash three amendments. So there's three amendments, the dash one, and I'm sorry that I don't have those all available. I have the dash three in front of me, and I thought the dash ones were coming up, and the dash twos.
I think the dash ones are, dash four is substitutes for dash one. So
there will be no
dash ones for dash four now.
Okay. What we're trying to do is just make sure we're covering all these bases and to take care of people's needs. We're trying to work with everybody so that we work out some sort of agreement so that we can just move forward with this. The dash three amendments, when we're talking about the nursing bill, we have an agreement, a work group that's been working on Senate Bill 800, and that is a combination of with Oregon Health Science University, community colleges, Nursing Association, some rural associations, to try and create a program so we can train nurses. There's no money available, obviously. Mm-hmm. So this would be a source of that particular money. So I'm available for any questions. We didn't add up to the whole 100%. We thought that we would try and if there's $73 million potentially coming into this pool of money, that we were looking at somewhere around 40% of that, mm-hmm. that we would be using. So that's where we're sitting with that situation, and we'll get these dash amendments to you and see if we can't dash two, threes, and fours.
Good. So. Thank you, and I'd like to say something as a chief co-sponsor of this bill, and I go back to the 4-day trip that we took through rural Oregon 2 years ago, and with Senator Fisher as chair of the committee, and visited rural health sites, and I really feel that we have to take care of the rural health care issues. And even though this MUPL money is temporary, I think that it's a bridge amount that will do some things right now that need to be done. And I am wholeheartedly in support of the bill. And we will hear about some of the other amendments. Ruby has a dash four, which replaces the three. So we will have, there will be three amendments. We don't have them, unfortunately, before us, so we'll have to come back another time, I guess. But
sure.
I just wanted to lend my support to what you're doing. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could just talk a little bit about on line 11 of the bill, which is talking about the Oregon Rural Health Association. This is an organization that in the last session we were funded to the tune of about $15 million, and then, of course, with all the legislative cuts, that was cut down to $3.75 million. We have not received that money in that organization at this point. It's based upon a model that's been very successful in the state of Washington that they've had for about the last 5 or 6 years, and they started in on the MUPL money earlier. We're just looking at how are you going to deliver services, medical services, to rural Oregon, and this is a new way of looking at it. It's based upon a model that is very successful, and we just need to get that money to get it started and get it going. And they're looking at trying to obtain grants outside of state government. So if they get the initial seed money, then they're able to go out and fund themselves in another manner. So it's looking at one-time money is basically is what we're doing here.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ken Hoffman, could you please come up? Okay. I just want to say that we're on a time crunch, and we have about a half an hour to, well, 25 minutes to spend on the bill, so we're going to have to move it along.
Mr. Chairman, as you know, I'm not Ken Hoffman. Ken Hoffman is the president of the Rural Health Association, but in real life, he's a nurse anesthetist, and he's in surgery right now, giving anesthesia. So he asked that I present his testimony on his behalf. And
I thought he was
permission.
Wearing a mask to impersonate you.
Better he give anesthesia than me trade job to them. But my real name is Ed Patterson, and I'm happy to present this testimony on behalf of President Ken Hoffman. I think you're having passed out to you the prepared testimony. I'm not going to read it, but ask that you have it entered into the record. Just to skim through it, and Senator Nelson talked a little bit about some of the history. I'm talking about the Section 1A of the bill, which deals with the rural health viability grants. And we're focusing strictly on that in this testimony and that piece of the bill. However, the Rural Health Association does totally endorse the entire bill. And having some knowledge about the Dash 3 and Dash 4 amendments, we also support the Dash 3 and Dash 4 amendments. So for the record, the Rural Health Association is supportive. A word about the Rural Health Association. It's an organization that has 41 different organizational members in it. It has 24 hospitals, and 6 rural health clinics, 9 professional organizations, and 2 Oregon Health Science University-based organizations, and over 270 individual members in the association. So we're a growing and viable public policy debating society, if you will, but all have only one thing in mind, is to improve the quality and improve access to rural health care in rural Oregon. As Senator Nelson alluded to, the legislature in 2001 did adopt a $15 million budget for the Rural Health Association to distribute and rural health viability grants. We took some major steps back and shortly after the session adjourned in creating a viable, financially manageable organization. We had adopted investment policies with some consultation with Morgan Stanley. We adopted some additional financial management policies for the association and are fully prepared to implement the bill House Bill 2515. We also contracted with the Office of Rural Health for part-time staff, since we had no permanent staff at that time, just to gear up for the potential of receiving the funds. As Senator Nelson said, a funny thing happened on the way to the bank. The funds never did arrive. However, we do know that there is $3.75 million still unallocated at this point. One of the primary reasons for supportive funding the Rural Health Viability Grant Program is to document what people in industry have recognized for some time, that small hospitals typically cannot modernize and expand facilities to meet community needs. Many of the hospitals, as we found out in the tour that you alluded to, Senator, have no funded depreciation, have no reserve funds, and have little access to capital because of their very fragile financial status. Most were built 50 or 60 years ago with federal Phil Burton funds and now are in need of either major renovations or replacement. Since state funding was not forthcoming, the Oregon Rural Health Association applied for and received a $60,000 grant from the Federal Office of Rural Health and proceeded to do an architectural assessment of those rural hospitals. We considered the request of 12 hospitals, and you'll see attached to the bound copy of that report, final report, there is a matrix on it in the very front page, and it shows a comparison of all these 12 hospitals and the findings. As you can see in that, on average, the original construction of these hospitals averaged 1959, but began in 1950 when several hospitals were constructed, and on up to about 1972. All but one of the 12 hospitals received Hill Burton funding. Of the hospitals, half were designated as type A hospitals, half were designated as type B hospitals, showing there really isn't a lot of difference between the A's and the B hospitals. In terms of the need improve inpatient rooms, on average, there's only 74% of compliance with current standards for patient rooms on those hospitals. And the nursing units themselves, where the nurses operate, they were only in 73% compliance of the regulations. The other departments, lab, x-ray, et cetera, were only in 72% of compliance with the current standards. So there's a significant need out there. I think a major finding that we found was that 92%, in fact, all but one of those 12 hospitals was in non-compliance with the American Disabilities Act. And only 67% of mechanical and electrical deficiencies noted. So with that comment, Mr. Chair, I'd like to say that we think passage and funding of Senate Bill 852 will head off a looming crisis in rural Oregon, and we'll urge this committee to adopt the amendments and adopt the bill and send it down to Ways and Means. I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Senator Fisher.
You have two graphs here. One that's in squares that says that there's only one that was built without Hill Burton. On the one on your testimony, it shows, too, that Hospital J also was built without Hill Burton. So there's a discrepancy between these two. I was wondering if I'm putting into the testimony, if we could straighten that up. Is it really one or is it two?
Senator Fisher, we had a phone call back yesterday, which didn't get into the written testimony, but the other hospital, and I believe, which is H?
F is no, and then the J is the one under question, the one in 1985.
J is the one who did receive Hill Burton funds.
They did, so yes. There is only one, so this is incorrect here.
That's correct.
Okay, I just wanted to double check and put that on the record since you were entering these in the record.
Sure.
Senator Minnis.
Okay, I want to ask, I guess what I think is kind of an obvious question, but it may not be. You're speaking to capital construction projects, I assume, with rural hospitals. Is that right?
That's correct.
All right. The bill doesn't talk about capital construction projects for rural hospitals.
Senator, Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis, the enabling bill was a bill that was adopted in 2515 last session, which is statutory. So this is merely a funding mechanism to fund what has already been adopted and charged with by a second.
All right, so 2515 from the 2001 session.
Correct.
Constrains these resources to capital construction. Is that correct?
It actually gives some flexibility so other rural health needs were met, but the legislative motivation, intent, if you will, mm-hmm. was to try to do something about these hospitals that complain in the four-day trip that the Senator alluded to, complain of not having access to capital and the inability to modernize.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman, I guess the question in my mind, it seems fine to use this divergence of MUPL money for the purpose of upgrading capital assets, but it doesn't seem very wise to do it for ongoing operations if that money is going to go away. So, but it could be used for operations, I assume.
Senator Menace, that you'll find in reviewing the statute, we're not locked into doing any specific project, but to establish a committee of persons that are aware of rural health issues to be kind of an oversight committee, an advisory committee, if you will, and then to prioritize what the requests will be when the grant requests come in and have it reviewed.
Okay. Thank you. Jeannie Budden.
Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jeannie Bowden. I'm the Associate Dean for OHSU School of Nursing in La Grande, and I've had oversight of two certified rural health clinics the last 8 years. I have fond memories of the field trip that was made over to our two clinics. So I come before you today to urge your support of Senate Bill 852. Our two rural health clinics are run by nurse practitioners, and these are RNs who have their master's degree and national certification, which allows them to diagnose and treat health problems. We offer lots of services in our two rural health clinics. We give complete history and physical exams. We do well child care, women's and men's comprehensive health care, diagnosis and treatment of common acute illnesses, bronchitis, earaches, those kinds of things. And we also manage chronic illnesses like diabetes, asthma, etc. Our nurse practitioners prescribe medications. They do diagnostic tests like EKGs, lab tests, screen for health problems. They also teach a lot of health education classes. They also do minor procedures like suturing lacerations or removing lesions. And we're on call 24/7. They do phone consultation, and they see patients after hours and on weekends, which really prevents overuse of the emergency rooms in our area. We have a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner who does mental health counseling in our two clinics. Now, despite a cost-effective model of delivering health care, many of Oregon's rural health clinics have a negative operating margin, and our two clinics are no exception. An Office of Rural Health survey shows that 23 of Oregon rural health clinics recover only 70% of their operating costs or patient revenues. And this simply means that rural health clinics have to make up the 30% difference some other way. Well, what makes these rural health clinics different from urban practices? And I know many of you are from the urban areas. There is a report from the National Institutes of Health that points out sparseness of population, these small towns, countryside, really make it difficult living so far from metropolitan areas which have ample clinics. In the frontier areas of our state, which a lot, most of them are out here in eastern Oregon, we have 6 people per square mile on the average, and that's really not enough people to keep our clinics hopping. With fewer population, we have fewer visits and therefore fewer resources for our clinics. We have mountainous terrain and poor quality roads, lack of transportation between metropolitan areas and these clinics. In the rural areas, we have a larger proportion of the uninsured and the underinsured, a larger proportion of persons living below the poverty threshold, hazardous working conditions, greater morbidity, and higher crude rates of mortality from all causes, more chronic diseases, and, of course, more frail elderly. These rural health clinics are vital to the social fabric and economy of these small underserved communities, and their presence, these clinics provide accessible services, especially for people who have trouble traveling. Some of our people don't have cars. They're too elderly to drive. For instance, our Elgin Family Health Center is 20 miles from La Grande, and these winter roads are terribly hazardous, and oftentimes they're closed. The Union and Elgin Family Health Services and clinics serve everyone, regardless of their ability to pay. They also provide social value, the peace of mind that really comes knowing that there's health care in one's community. In fact, when people come to look to see if they would like to move or start a business in Elgin or Union, one of the first questions they ask is there a clinic in this community? They also provide jobs to providers and support staff. Now, we've collected stories from our patients over the years and asked them why they come to our clinics when they're on their last legs. And when asked, they tell us that they're really too intimidated to come to La Grande for care. So we have really become the health care navigators out there. A couple of quotes from our patients. I'll be brief. Why do I go to a nurse practitioner for my care? Because they're concerned with me as a person, as well as a patient. They're willing to listen to me, and the level of care is very high. They're not hesitant to send me to someone else if my problems are beyond their expertise. Another person, an elderly person, said, I owe my life to Sue in this clinic. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for them. Well, nearly half of the patients seen in our two clinics are without insurance, on the Oregon Health Plan, or on Medicare. We have over 5,000 visits a year. Operations in both of our clinics are simply day-to-day, like many rural health clinics. If we can't sustain a break-even status, we'll have to close our doors. Rural health clinics are vital to our state's health safety net, and as rural health clinics are often the only provider in the community, our legislature must ensure the continued availability of quality, cost-effective care in rural underserved areas. And again, I urge you to support Senate Bill 852. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeannie. Question? Okay. Seeing no questions, Alan Parks.
Mr. Chairman and committee, thank you for allowing the time. I am Alan Parks from Northlake Health District in Christmas Valley, Oregon. When you think of rural health care, please think of us. We're 100 miles from the Bend Hospital or the Lakeview Hospital, and there's very little in the way of medical care in between those points. We presently have a nurse practitioner and a nurse slash receptionist, and we are operating a viable clinic. It's under the supervision of Dr. Bruce Carlson, and I won't read everything there on the information sheet that I brought in essence of time, but we have passed a tax base in November of 2000. Our community is actively supporting the clinic, but as was stated in the previous testimony, we're not running over with money. We're operating in a couple of used modular office buildings, and we're getting by. We have some grants in the works to improve the facility, and we're working hard at establishing a second provider as well. We definitely have a need there, and if there is money to be to be shared with the rural communities. I believe that it's money well spent to contribute to these rural health clinics like ours. I know that the Jordan Valley Clinic is in worse shape than we are. There's some huge needs out there. There's a lot of low-income people, and I can promise you that if the money comes to our district, it'll be put to use and it'll be used well.
Okay.
Thank you.
How do you relate this to economic development? Can you make that, can you bridge that gap?
How far shall we reach? Certainly, there's a number of retiring people moving to our community, and of course, retirees are not in excess of 65 years old anymore. They may be, but there's a lot of younger people. But as people relocate, one of the things they want to see is what's going to happen with health care. That when it is difficult to travel 100 miles to town, will I be able to see a health care provider in my neighborhood? And so, yes, as we improve our facility, that certainly opens things up to expansion. You know, certainly the retired community is an industry, and serving those folks. Other small businesses that are looking for an area to develop often look at what facilities are available. There's Forest Service Complex in Silver Lake. As those employees relocate around the country, they look at what schools are available and other services. So yes, it is an economic development issue also.
Good. Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Just one quick question, Mr. Park. I love the photos on the front. Did somebody really ride in on that horse to get health care?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, there is a little travel that way, but no, that's a gimme.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Paul McGinnis.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Paul McGinnis, and I direct field services for the Oregon Office of Rural Health, and today I'm representing the interests of many of the clinics, rural health clinics around the state. I've provided some photos of a few on the front, as Senator Walker pointed out, the Christmas Valley one. I can't take credit for the photo credit there. It was a board member who happened upon the clinic one day, Judy Lynch, and just snapped that photo. And
that doesn't represent anything.
It's been a prize for us. the clinic in the bottom right-hand corner, the Pine Eagle Clinic in Halfway, this Saturday I get to do a board retreat out there, and those folks have replaced that facility. They have
halfway.com.
Not anymore, sir.
Not anymore.
Excuse me. They ran out on that. But I've been asked to talk about the needs for technical assistance at these rural health clinics. And when myself and colleagues in the field services staff travel to these rural communities, we're working with people whose jobs have very little to do with health care. And, you know, I've been doing rural health work now for 20 years, and it takes all of my time just to stay confused. And so you can imagine what it's like for board members who meet one time a month and try to manage a service. It's like your first committee assignment. You may have been assigned to transportation, and you think, oh, I know roads. And then you get into it, and you find out how little we really do know about things. There are five working definitions of rural right now that all have different resources tied to them. How can we expect someone like Mr. Parks to be able to understand all those little intricacies to get the value for their community? He cares about a clinic there. So we provide technical assistance to these people in many forms, but they have different governing structures, different history. Many have no management. Imagine your committee without an administrator. Many of these clinics don't have any office staff. It's the provider and someone answering the phone. And the boards are having to make decisions. There's a great deal of viability in their management information system. Some of the clinics can produce numbers that help them do better management decision-making. These resources, I'm sure, would help them get better systems so that they can make informed choices. There's great variability on the continuity of providers. If you don't have a steady source of funds, these providers change over. That just causes a snowballing effect on whether or not they can survive.
Now, we're going to have to move along.
I just want to say that, you know, when we're talking about rural health clinics, much of the debate in health policy deals with accessibility. Rural health clinics are about availability. First, there has to be a provider out there before we can worry about access barriers due to finances and other reasons. And, you know, we try to provide services to make sure that private providers are out there. If they can't make a go of it, we provide services to help these places create nonprofits and get grant monies and keep themselves going. If they can't do it like North Lake did, we help them form health districts where they tax themselves in order to keep health care in their communities. So I urge your support of Senate Bill 852 and would welcome any questions.
Thank you.
Questions?
Thank you very much. Karen Whitaker and Ruby Hunt, please. Now, we are running short of time, so keep that in mind in your testimony, please. Speed talk?
Yeah.
We have to speed listen then, I guess.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ruby Houghton. I'm the Legislative and Public Affairs Director for CURE Oregon. CURE Oregon is a not-for-profit 501c3 health plan. And we utilize the safety net to support our client base, and many of them are a part of our provider panel. You have before you, or it's getting in front of you here in a minute, a brief amendment to Senate Bill 852. These are the Dash 4 amendments that Senator Nelson spoke to you about. The amendments are brief, and what they do is they add in, and I think if you take a look at what Mr. McGinnis just provided you with, there are rural health clinics that are federally certified rural health clinics. Then there are federally qualified health centers in rural Oregon, as well as independent clinics. And Karen Whitaker and I have served as members, as well as Jeannie Bowden, who you just spoke with, and many others, on the Healthcare Safety Net Coalition in support of safety net clinics throughout Oregon. And so we bring this amendment to you today, recognizing that the Oregon Health Plan, relative to the standard population, is having grand difficulty. Standard population are those people who are not categorical, for which Representative Nelson's stakeholder group has not provided a benefit. And these individuals are and will continue to flood into Oregon's health care safety net, and as a result will cause an undue burden on our safety net clinics unless we provide them with some additional support. I wanted to make that clear to you today, because oftentimes we don't view the safety net as an integral part of our healthcare system, when in fact it is, particularly for low-income and rural Oregonians throughout our state who have limited access because they don't carry an insurance card and because they are not members of the full-time employment opportunities of health insurance. So I wanted to make that statement to you today. I know that you don't have a lot of time, and I wanted to make sure that Karen provided you with a bit more background. If you have questions for me, I'll be around once you finish your committee, or you can just give me a ring. Okay?
Thank you, Ruby. Karen.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Karen Whitaker. I'm the director of the Oregon Office of Rural Health at Oregon Health and Science University, and I'm here to talk about two issues with you very briefly. The first is I'd like to second Ruby's support for the Dash 4 amendments. What they basically do is extend support to all of the rural safety net, not just those clinics that are defined as federally certified rural health clinics. It would include also school-based clinics, which are an important part of primary care in rural communities, and some independent, smaller clinics that are not certified rural health clinics. It would add, by my estimate, about 40 clinics to the list of those clinics that would be eligible for assistance through Senate Bill 852. And I also wanted to talk with you briefly about the section of Senate Bill 852 that affects rural emergency medical services, and that is Section 1D. Like Section 1A, that supports an existing program that in the past has been funded through the Unitary Assessment Account Public Safety Fund that is slated to end as of this biennium. We have been receiving in our office about $650,000 per biennium to provide primarily equipment to very rural emergency medical services providers, most of whom are volunteers. And the map that I've given you shows how those funds have been distributed to date. We've distributed about a little over $1 million, and we've had requests for a little over $5 million. We have purchased 7 ambulances, 3 quick response four-wheel drive vehicles, 60 defibrillators, 7 ventilators, 101 radios, 76 pagers, and 11 Jaws of Life rescue extrication tools. The organizations that apply to us are primarily staffed by volunteers. They operate at an average deficit of nearly $30,000 per year, and they serve a total of 150,000 rural Oregonians annually. And, of course, they don't serve just rural Oregonians. Every one of us who lives in a metropolitan area, almost without exception, spends some time in rural Oregon, and so those emergency medical services providers serve the entire state as people travel in rural Oregon. And I think that's all I have to say. If you have some questions for me, I'd be very happy to take your questions, and certainly hope that you can see fit to fund Senate Bill 852.
Okay. Thank you.
With amendments.
With the dash four amendments. Yes.
Good bill should pass.
Thank you for that advice. Thank you. Sandy Ryman, please.
Hello. For the record, I'm Sandy Ryman, the director of Northeast Oregon Area Health Education Center in La Grande, and I'm going to be very brief. I have spoken with you before about my concerns about rural emergency medical technician education. EMTs are the backbone of the care system in Oregon, particularly in our rural areas. I'm specifically interested in your funding section 1E of the legislation, which would provide, through Senate Bill 852, approximately $500,000 to continue with the funding of education for rural emergency volunteer services. The need is very important, even though this money is perhaps a temporary solution. It's important to keep a critical mass to keep the system workable. It's essential that the volunteers that are out there have other volunteers that can be educated, or those who already exist will leave the service. And that's why I'm stating the critical mass is quite important. I've provided you with all the similar numbers that I've provided to you previously, and would entertain questions at this time.
Well, a comment. I remember talking to an EMT and one.
Yes, Darlene Starr from Spray.
And I remember the cost of training that they bore themselves as volunteers in some cases, and that's the first line of defense if you're overturned on a windy road in the middle
Absolutely.
Of winter. And my concern is if you lose the volunteers, you lose the programs, and it does take some money to keep people involved in addition to what they put in. I know we went to Sumter, and their big way of getting money was a bake sale. Once a year, they do a bake sale to pay for their ambulance service, and it's incredible the amount of I guess, dedication and so on that goes on without even recognition oftentimes from the legislature. And so,
you're right, Mr. Chair. It's very expensive to educate these people, and it takes 150 hours of their time just to become certified. And then they are required to have additional hours of continuing education beyond that. So Senate Bill 852 would be able to fund both the initial education and the continuing education for these volunteers. It reduces at least one of those barriers that are significant.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Fisher, for co-sponsoring this legislation with Senator Dave Nelson.
Thank you. Ken Rutledge.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ken Rutledge. I'm president of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. That's a position I've held since 1988. We represent all of Oregon's 61, both private and public hospitals. We also represent the 9 district nursing homes who you heard about who are involved in the development of the MUPL money. I'd like to begin on a positive note by saying that we
I'd like you to end on a positive.
I'm not certain I'm going to be able to. We do support the amendment that would remove the A and B hospitals funding from this. I think the reasons are fairly clear. There's a statutory requirement for A and B hospitals to be paid cost-based reimbursement. We obviously support that, and we hope that this committee will continue to support that requirement stay in place. It's interesting, particularly the grant program. This is my association was one of the major promoters of that in the 2001 legislative session. And if you take a look at all of the worthwhile rural programs that have been described today, not only are we supportive of those programs, but I think in many, many cases, my membership provides both direct financial support and indirect support to as many of these rural facilities as possible. Let me tell you what my concern is. First of all, if we take a look at what is happening with health care today, the recession has hit us. What we've seen is that the number of people who are covered by commercial insurance has declined. Our Medicaid and our Medicare and our uninsured patient loads are growing. The bottom lines are shrinking. And quite frankly, we're not at the point yet where any of the really bad things that may potentially happen as a result of the state's budget have occurred. As I think you may be aware, despite the fact that the legislature was not allowed to participate in this decision, the Oregon Medical Assistance Program made a decision effective March 1 to do across-the-board cuts of 12% to payments to non-A and B hospitals. In addition, they have eliminated what's called retroactive eligibility, which means not only for hospitals but also for rural clinics and urban safety net clinics. When people come in and do not have their coverage in effect yet, the state will no longer pay those bills. The projected impact of that over the remainder of this biennium and into next biennium is $48 million less in payments to hospitals, to physicians, and to rural clinics and urban clinics. If you take a look at the work that's being done by the House committee headed by Representative Westland, it's really kind of terrifying. What we're seeing right now is that the general fund shortfall for the Oregon Health Plan to continue on a continuing basis approaches $600 million in state general fund. If you look at what we can afford with what is currently budgeted, we're talking about eliminating 150,000 people on the Oregon Health Plan, the so-called standard population, or almost a third of the entire population. Even when we do that, thank you. Even when we do that, there's not enough money left over to provide a prescription drug benefit for the 300-plus thousand people who will remain, much less mental health, chemical dependency, durable medical goods. And here's our concern. While all of these are worthwhile projects, the concern that we have is that the Oregon Health Plan is about to fall apart in a way that's going to be devastating not only to the people who are covered by the Oregon Health Plan, but to the health care infrastructure of the state. And that clearly is going to have some economic consequences. The position my board has taken is to oppose this legislation. What we would like to see and what we're going to be working for throughout this legislative session is to find as many dollars as possible to put into the Oregon Health Plan so that we can not only keep as much of it as in place as possible, with all the ramifications that has for urban and rural providers as well, but also so that we don't lose the federal dollars, the $1.50 for every state dollar that'll go away if we lose that money. Remember, that $600,000 shortfall translates into almost a $2 billion hole in the Oregon Health Plan, $1.5 billion hole in the Oregon Health Plan. So unfortunately, we have to oppose Senate Bill 852, not because we don't think all of these are very worthy projects, but because of the implications of diverting any dollars that could possibly be put into the Oregon Health Plan. You asked me to finish on a positive note, and the positive note that I'll finish on is that given the choice between having the dollars flow to these projects and to the education fund that the governor has currently budgeted the money for, I would prefer the former. Thank you. And I'll answer any questions.
Any questions? Senator Shields.
Thank you. You're looking at both sides. I mean, you're looking at the needs of this infrastructure out there in the rural community, and you're looking at the needs of the health plan and its potential demise. How do you end up coming? I mean, both. It's Hobson's choice. How do you end up coming down on one side or the other?
Well, I think here's one of the ways that I do that. If you take a look at the 31 A and B hospitals, it would be wonderful if particularly some of those older hospitals could find a source of money to do capital improvements. But the fact of the matter is that if we lose a third of the people on the Oregon Health Plan, keeping in mind that many of these hospitals already have operating losses, many of them are supported by local governmental districts, if we lose a third of the people in these hospitals that already have a disproportionate share of their patients covered by government programs that don't pay the actual cost, except in the case of the Medicaid program because of the statutes here, it's not going to matter whether we have money to do capital improvements, because they're going to be swamped in so much red ink that in many instances I think they're going to go under. And so, in effect, you can do the capital improvements, but if the economy has driven away so many people who were covered by commercial insurance, and then you lose a third of the people and go from cost-based reimbursement to zero reimbursement, then I think the priority for those rural hospitals, anyway, is to somehow or another keep their operations afloat, be able to make payroll, and to keep their doors open, as opposed to using money for capital improvements when, in effect, there's a question about whether they'll survive simply because of what's happening. It's not an easy decision. It's the same kind of thing that you're dealing with. And where we have come down is that we're doing everything that we can, not only in terms of trying to convince the legislature, but looking at ways in which we can come up with additional dollars to put into the Oregon Health Plan to maximize the federal match and to try and keep this program afloat, realizing that the demise of that program and a third of that population is going to swamp whatever good is being done by this bill and the allocation.
Senator Minnis.
Mr. Rutledge, educate me, will you, on the rural hospitals. You mentioned 31, and you suggested that absent OHP standard, the reimbursement, the current Medicaid mandatory populations will continue, but absent a population being covered above that level, you suggest that these rural facilities will close or could close.
Some.
All right. So help me understand, was there an expansion of these facilities after 1993 when we started funding the Oregon Health Plan above the Medicaid mandatory population?
Well, there's no one of the things that first happened, and a lot of this is unfortunately eroded, but when you look at bad debts and you look at charity care, initially those went down because basically what we're talking about is the Oregon Health Plan having been expanded by, at that point, roughly 50% from 300,000 to 450,000. So clearly, because those were based on cost-based reimbursement, you have a significantly larger part of the population who's using your hospital for which you're getting reimbursement. So it clearly had a positive impact on them, yes.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, can't again help me understand this because I don't recall that there was an expansion of these kind of rural facilities once the Oregon Health Plan above the Medicaid mandatory populations were funded to the extent that they were. So I guess I'm trying to figure out how
when you talk about expansion.
Well, I'm talking about the population above the federally mandated population. So when we say Oregon Health Plan, we're mixing and matching here. But I'm talking about what's in jeopardy now is the OHP standard population, which
correct.
Is that portion not required by the federal government. So what I'm guessing trying to figure out is you implied that if that goes away, that these rural facilities will collapse and won't exist. But they existed before the health plan. So I'm trying to figure out, I guess, what the difference is between then and now.
Well, I think there are a number of things that are different. First of all, if you look at the Medicare program, the level of payment by Medicare has eroded significantly. I think that's one of the factors.
But it was a problem in 1993, too.
Well, I mean, clearly, as a result of the Oregon Health Plan, a lot of the rural facilities are in better condition. That condition is declining, but they're in significant...
They've improved their facilities, haven't they? Because they look pretty trashy to me. I mean,
well, a lot of them have improved their facilities. If you take a look around the state, we have new hospitals in a lot of communities, and I think one of the reasons is the financials, at least improved financial stability, was brought about, once again, by having a significantly larger part of the population that uses those hospitals and who don't have the ability to pay, actually covered by an insurance program that for rural hospitals pay them the actual cost of providing care.
Thank you.
What's the role? What do you see the role of safety net clinics?
I think safety net clinics are probably one of the most cost-effective ways of dealing with the Medicaid population and keeping people out of hospital emergency rooms where it is significantly more expensive to care for them. I mean, clearly, in conjunction with a larger picture of the Oregon Health Plan, we feel that safety net clinics ought to be getting more money and more consideration simply because the traditional physician population is not active with the Oregon Health Plan. So we strongly support both rural and urban safety net clinics.
Good. That's why I asked Ruby to amend this bill, because I think that given the problems that we're having with the Oregon Health Plan, the safety net clinics take on a greater role, and I think that's...
As I said, it's not a matter of us opposing any of these projects. We think they're all worthy projects. The problem, once again, that we have is that we're talking about losing possibly as much as $1.5 billion in health care funds that would be flowing through our health delivery system.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, one question.
Yes, question.
So you're supporting amendments 2, 3, and 4?
I'm supporting the amendment that removes A and B hospitals.
That's two.
Right. But unfortunately, as I indicated, we are opposed to the bill. We prefer that the MUPL money be used to support, be part of the support to continue the Oregon Health Plan and not be diverted to a variety of different very worthy projects.
Okay. Good. Okay. Thank you. We'll close the public hearing and open a work session. And I guess I will say that I know there are some objections by various parties to using this MUPL money for what it was supposed to be used for, because there are other black holes that have to be filled. I am really concerned about rural health care, not only for the people of all ages who live there, including the nursing homes that may be in danger of closing in some communities. I see it as an economic development tool for rural Oregon. We can talk all we want about economic development and moving dirt and doing all of those things, but what company in their right mind would move to an area where they don't have adequate schools and adequate health care? So to me, this bill makes a statement. Whether or not the Ways and Means Committee would agree with it, I don't know, but my feeling is we have to make a statement that this is important. And if they move money around, they damn well better leave some for rural Oregon. That's my feeling. So I would like to see this bill move to Ways and Means.
A motion?
Yes, I would love a motion.
Which amendment do you want?
Oh. 2, 3, and 4.
2, 3, and 4.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's my understanding that you can't have 2 and 3, that you have to select one of those.
One or the other.
Okay. Would you go through the amendments? I thought I had them down.
We can have Ruby come up and explain her dash 4, okay. And how about let's have Bruce come up and do his dash 2, and Senator Nelson was back there, and he can do 3.
Okay, very good. So would the three of you come up, please, and we'll start in reverse order. We'll start with 4.
Okay.
Thank you.
No, I didn't want to sit in the center.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the dash 4 amendments to this bill add in non-federally certified rural health clinics, so that federally certified rural health clinics are included in the bill, as are non-federally certified rural health clinics. So it includes all rural health clinics in rural Oregon. And the definition is tied to the Office of Rural Health. You've heard from Karen Whitaker, and she provided you with there are approximately 40 additional clinics that are included in this dollar amount.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. David Nelson, Senator from California. I think the dash 3s are actually the ones that are supposed to be the proper one, because it deletes the rest of lines 14 and 15, and that takes out the NB hospitals, and then adds in the Department of Administrative Service for grants for post-secondary education to support nursing programs. So I'm looking at 3 and 4. Take the proper amendments.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
If you're ready.
Yes.
I'll move the adoption of the dash 3 and dash 4 amendments.
Okay.
To Senate Bill 852.
Okay. Senator Menendez moves the adoption of dash 3 and dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 852. Would you call the roll, please?
Senator
Menendez. Aye.
Senator Shields. Senator
Starr. Aye.
Senator Walker.
Aye.
Senator Fisher.
Aye.
Senator Morrison.
Aye. So that takes care of the amendments. Thank you. Thank you. Yes.
Mr. Chair, at this time, move Senate Bill 852 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay. Senator Menendez moves Senate Bill 852 as amended to Ways and Means.
To my motion?
To the motion.
I'm facilitating moving this to Ways and Means, but I think Mr. Rutledge's comments are instructive. I think that on the entire issue of the Oregon Health Plan and the various populations that might not be served based on current fiscal issues are things that all of the members will have to keep in the forefront of our thinking as we come to the middle and subsequent portions of this session. So, whether it's Medicaid upper limit monies that fund these programs or otherwise, I think that the chair of this committee and the other health policy committee or human resource committee need to be flexible to the extent that the co-chairs of Ways and Means would like to facilitate putting together a package that actually functions and works. So this is one component part of it, and hopefully we'll have continued discussions and come to some resolutions that will help with these issues. So That's my little dissertation.
Yes, Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, because I would echo Senator Menace on that. I appreciate these programs. I think they're valuable. Safety net clinics are incredible. All of the services we can offer to the rural system, but we do have to think about the Oregon Health Plan as well. And so I like the concept. I appreciate the chief sponsors bringing this forward. And I'm just hopeful that when it gets down in Ways and Means, we can work it all out and try to fund all of these programs the best we can.
Thank you. Other comments? I guess I would say that there have been several entities that have not wanted to move this bill, including the governor's office, but in spite of that, I think it's important to move it, to make a statement, and Ways and Means will sort it out. But I think that we have made the statement that these are important programs, and my feeling is there's, if you cut the larger quantities, the cuts are not as deep as if you cut the smaller quantities. And so making very small cuts in some rural Oregon communities wipe out the program, where making a larger cut in a metropolitan area doesn't wipe out the program. It makes it more difficult. So I think we have to look at in terms of where we can least afford to cut. And I think some of these rural Oregon programs come under that category. So I want to send a message to Ways and Means that these are important programs. So any other comments? Okay, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Menace?
Aye.
Senator Shields? Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye. Okay. Senate Bill 852, having received the majority vote, will go to Ways and Means, and we will close the work session and open a public hearing on HJR 4. And Kathy Britton, Dr. Parks, and Senator Nelson.
Dr. Parker, can you hear us?
Dr. Parker.
Oh, good.
You can hear us.
Dr. Parker, we can't hear you.
Okay, Senator Nelson, why don't you go ahead and get started. We hope we will get Dr. Parker.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, my name is David Nelson, State Senator from Pendleton, representing the four counties, Umatilla, Union, Morrow, and Wallowa counties. I'm here in support of House Joint Resolution 4, which is a resolution that will encourage healthcare payers to reimburse for services delivered via telecommunications technology, the same way they reimburse for services delivered in person. And this is, a statement that all is related, that we're talking about living services in new and different ways, and that we have to recognize that. I think this is in some ways related to the previous bill that you just discussed, is that we're looking for solutions in rural health. And this is one of the situations that I think has proven to be successful. I've been at meetings with RESD in Pelton, which young children have come in and were diagnosed and are treated by a doctor in Bend via telecommunications, where they were able, children were able to crawl and walk along the floor, and it was an orthopedic type situation, and where the doctor was able to make some sort of a diagnosis and to discuss, treatments and procedures. The big issue is the distance in Eastern Oregon is a lot bigger than you think. It's actually closer for me in Pendleton to drive to Portland than it is for me to drive to Bend. It's about 250 miles from Pendleton to Bend. So when you think of Eastern Oregon, there's a lot of distance out there. So it's better for us to come to Portland. And forensics, if we were going to do the forensics lab, put one to Bend, we wouldn't do that. We'd come to Portland just because it's closer. But that's what this bill is trying to do. It's a combination. We started back in 1997. There was a what they call the Oregon Telecommunications Forum Council. That one of its goals to create local health care. 1999, we did Senate Bill 622, which created infrastructure. And 2001, we did Oregon Health Science University, and they connect with us folks out in rural Oregon in a huge, huge way. So this is all just a accumulation of putting together pieces and moving forward and now doing the implementation so that people have greater health care access. Thank you.
Thank you. Question?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Good Senator, is this a way of avoiding a mandate, or why do we not just have a regular bill?
Well, we didn't want to do a mandate, basically. I mean, we just thought that wasn't the right thing to do.
That is what you're trying to avoid.
Yeah, we're just trying to say this is the policy and this is what we'd like to do. And I think there may be some assistance, some help, but if you're negotiating contracts, saying this is the policy of the state.
Kathy, are you on the video?
Thank you, Senator Nelson.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kathy? Do you guys...
Okay, we're going to close the public hearing and open a work session on HJR 4. Do I have a motion on HJR 4?
Mr. Chair, yes. I would move that we send HJR to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. It's Senator Fisher moves
back in
the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any comments?
Yeah, it looks like we should go back to.
Are you keep going?
You want to vote on it and go back to a hearing?
Yeah, let's go ahead and. Any comments on any further discussion on the vote? Would you please call the roll?
Aye.
Senator Shields? Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye.
Morissette?
Aye. HJR 4 has passed unanimously and will go to the Senate floor for approval with a due pass recommendation. Dr. Parker, did you hear that?
Yes, I did. Thank you very much. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. So the system works.
In view of the motion you've just passed, perhaps I should just let my comments be read into the record and let you proceed.
Okay. Yes, briefly do that. Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
I don't know if we can.
I think Dr. Parker, just his comments are in the record here, and I think.
Okay, Dr. Parker, we do have your comments in writing, and we can read them into the record.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Here.
Yes. Yeah, go ahead, Senator Fisher. Senator Fisher? Okay, we're going to close this public hearing one more time. Thank you, Dr. Parker.
Thank you.
Good. Okay, we're going to move into a mental health chemical dependency presentation. Constance Powell, would you come, please? Leslie Ford and Kim Hartnett, please come up. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Well, it's interesting that our HJR lied to the system, it didn't work.
Sorry.
Yes, please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Connie Powell. I'm a psychiatrist in private practice in Portland, and I'm president of the Oregon Medical Association, which represents 6,800 physicians. And I want to thank you for this opportunity to address you on the topic of non-discrimination against mental illness and substance abuse in health care insurance benefits. This is a priority issue of the Oregon Medical Association. It is not an economic issue for our membership. It's part of advocating for our patients. Insurers unfairly discriminate against their policyholders who have mental illness by limiting their coverage through higher copays, allowing fewer outpatient visits, fewer inpatient hospitalization days, and lower annual and lifetime caps than are provided for other medical illnesses. For mental illness, the medical illness, other medical illnesses, insurance criteria for coverage is medical necessity. This is a reasonable criteria. For mental illness, there is that criteria and then the additional one of a dollar limit or a durational limit. So the care that is allowed does not necessarily conform to the standard of treatment for the illness, which is the standard in all other arenas. In 1987, as you know, 16 years ago, the Oregon legislature passed legislation that established a minimum mental health benefit. And Oregon insurers adopted this as the maximum benefit. This was 16 years ago. In 1999, the Oregon legislature increased the dollar amount of this structure of benefits, minimums, effective July 2000. And this is the current benefit for people with these policies in Oregon now. That's $2,500 in a two-year period for outpatient mental health care, and $7,500 for inpatient treatment should someone need hospitalization, that renews every 2 years, and an additional $2,500 that floats can possibly be applied for inpatient hospitalization or for residential treatment. This is as good as it gets for mental health benefits in Oregon outside of the PEB system, and unusual in that there is no catastrophic insurance. We usually think of the minimal insurance as being should there be a health care disaster that protects the economic structure of the family and the individual. There is no catastrophic insurance for mental illness in Oregon. In 1997, the Oregon Medical Association surveyed physicians, and they strongly voiced their patients have inadequate access to mental health care. This was primary care physicians and specialists who are seeing patients, not for mental illness, but whose patients present with mental illness in addition to their other reasons for coming to the doctor. These physicians said that of their patients who needed mental health care, 30% of them needed more outpatient treatment than their insurance policies allowed them. And 18% with mental health needs, needing hospitalization, needed more care than their hospital policies, than their insurance policies allowed them. In the OMA's opinion, it's their opinion that this discrimination in health care benefits based on an artificial distinction between mental and physical health confounds the treatment of all medical illness. The physicians reported that 1 in 4, 25% of their patients have a psychiatric component to their health care problem. So, for example, it's common to develop a depression after having a heart attack, which makes sense. But an untreated depression is the greatest risk for a second heart attack. There is a 4 times increased incidence of your second heart attack if you have a depression after your first one. Treatment of depression in these patients is medically necessary, and it can't be separated. Mental illness is common. 1 in 4 people gets mental illness, and the severity, of course, is variable as in all illnesses. And because it's common, the findings of the Moore poll are understandable. I didn't provide you with this, but I will. Oregon citizens are aware they need insurance coverage for mental illness. The Moore poll of 500 Oregonians in February of 1999 found that 70% of Oregonians favored requiring health insurance companies to provide the same level of benefits for mental health and alcohol and drug treatment as provided for people with physical illnesses. 75%, they themselves were willing or very willing to personally pay the extra $1.27 a month that it would cost. 23% of those polled reported that they or someone in their family had obtained treatment for mental health or alcohol and drug treatment in the past 5 years. So we're hitting the national averages. When asked, did your insurance company cover your expenses, 1 in 4 said no. 25% had none of their expenses covered. 29% had some of their expenses covered. 17% had a majority of the expenses covered, and 20% had all of their costs covered. I'm a psychiatrist in private practice, and even though mental illness and substance abuse are common problems, it's unlikely that any of us don't know people in our personal lives who have had some trouble with one or both of those. But people are often surprised to develop these illnesses. Somehow we don't expect it to happen. They often have no awareness of the limitations of their insurance coverage. They haven't considered it. They feel they're paying their premiums. They have coverage for the illnesses that they can be expected to get. They are surprised. Some policyholders can pay out of pocket for medical treatment in addition to paying their insurance premiums, and some can't. The discrimination against mental illness in insurance benefits in Oregon can, as you can see, have a disastrous effect on the individual. They don't have catastrophic coverage. They're not necessarily aware of what they don't have. There was actually a proposal in Washington that, I don't know how far it's gotten, that insurance carriers be required to inform their policyholders of what they don't have covered specifically in terms of mental health. But this treatment shouldn't be out of the reach of these policyholders. Mental illnesses are among the most effectively treated medical conditions. The literature reports treatment success rates of 80% for panic disorder, 85% for depression, 60% for obsessive compulsive disorder, 80% for manic depression, 60% for schizophrenia. So in their extreme forms, these illnesses are severe and persistent, but there, in my practice, I have patients with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder who respond to medications, hold jobs, get along in their lives as well as any of us. These are treatable disorders. It's not unusual for an individual to experience chest pain because of anxiety. These patients fear they may be having a heart attack and often go to the emergency room for evaluation, and often repeatedly. Psychiatric treatment for this problem is 80% effective and considerably less expensive than visits to the emergency room. In an OMA survey, physicians reported that 10% of their patients have psychosomatic disorders. The impact of withholding treatment for mental illness has been studied extensively. Untreated alcoholics or drug-dependent persons use health care and incur costs at a rate twice that of their age and gender cohorts. People who choose potentially lethal suicide methods were more likely to drink within three hours of the attempt and to have sought help from family or friends, not professionals. As with all illness, appropriate early treatment is cost-effective. A 1996 study by the National Institute of Mental Health conducted found that mental and addictive disorders cost over $300 billion annually in productivity losses, time off work, health care costs, and other costs, the criminal justice system, etc. So we're only discussing the impact on the health care premium, but as far as the policy of the state, the other costs are worth considering. When individuals have mental health treatment needs beyond their insurance coverage and cannot afford to pay, they run the risk of serious personal and economic negative consequences. They can lose their families and their jobs. With job loss, they can move to the public sector. And this is not uncommon, and we hear this a lot from physicians. The Oregon Health Plan has in the past provided mental health care for many Oregonians with inadequate private insurance coverage. In a 1993 report to Congress, the National Mental Health Advisory Council reported that care is often shifted to the public sector when insurance should pay. Quote, the enormous but often hidden costs of untreated or undertreated severe mental illness, which are now borne by the general health care system and society at large, excuse me, can be appreciably reduced. Oregon taxpayers cannot afford a continued shift of health care responsibility from the public to the private sector. states that there are 33 states that have passed various expanded non-discrimination bills, and you have a handout that lists them. There are different categories that have done different kind of versions of them, and some states, actually a number of states, have gone back and expanded their original expansion based on their experience. The reason that there are so many is that as experience from states come in, it's very positive. The actuarial reports, initial actuarial reports before anyone had experience, predicted 3.something to 4% as being the cost of both substance abuse and mental illness treatment, but the real experience is that it seems to cost around 1%. Some states report a little bit more, some states report a little bit less. And those who have studied a RAND Corporation study looking at it thought that part of that, well, The assumptions of the actuaries were quite conservative. They took into account no cost offset. So, for example, they didn't take into account if you treat a depression and the patient doesn't have the second heart attack, there's a health savings to the system. They didn't take into account that if the patient sees a psychiatrist, gets medication for panic disorder and doesn't go to the emergency department for a heart evaluation, that it saves money. So they didn't take into account any of those things that do happen. They also didn't take into account that for most healthcare systems, we weren't talking a new benefit, a new treatment, but we were talking expansion of existing treatments that wouldn't be needed by the whole population, that it would just be needed by a subset of the population. So now we have loads of experience with this, it seems to cost about 1%. But that's to the premium. That's not taking into account the savings, both in terms of the individual's well-being of receiving the appropriate kind of treatment, or to society for not having to pick up the costs elsewhere when the patient can't hold his life together. Fortunately, there are no reality barriers for doing the right thing here. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Leslie?
My name is Leslie Ford.
You know what? My name wasn't
Kim, would you like to?
You had it right. My name is Leslie Ford. I'm the CEO of Cascadia Behavioral Healthcare. We're an addictions and mental health provider. We do everything from crisis respite and detox through outpatient supported housing for children through seniors. We provide services in Marion County, Multnomah County, and Washington County. Last year, we saw 21,000 people. This next year, it will be fewer. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the committee, for your attention to these issues that are very important to many, many Oregonians. As I understand it, my job here today was to talk about how, in light of the lack of parity in this state, the public sector has taken up the slack or provided the safety net for those with chronic and persistent psychiatric disorders over the last couple of decades. Two or three years ago, I had the pleasure of listening to a somewhat irreverent keynote speech given by the head of the primary medicine department at OHSU. The topic of the conference was, how do we go about integrating the treatment of addictions and mental health problems with the delivery of primary care given our current financial structures? The title of his address was The Influence of Descartes on the Development of Modern Medicine, or Descartes, I Spit on You. It was his thesis that the mind-body split, I think therefore I am, separate from soul, spirit, and body, laid the groundwork for splitting the treatment of the mind and its effects on the behavior off from the treatment of the rest of the body. We now realize that this fragmented attitude is not in the best interests of those we serve or science. For the world of biology and psychobiology, this part of his philosophy, and forgive me for any philosophy majors here who know more about this than I do, has now finally come to be regarded as obviously short-sighted and an incomplete understanding of how our bodies, minds, and psyches together create ourselves and our health. That awareness, as obvious as it may now seem with our new, relatively speaking, knowledge of the biological basis of psychiatric disorders and the effects on the brain of addictive substances, is a long way from being fully recognized by society, our financial institutions, and by the insurance industry, despite reams of cost offset data and scientific evidence that Dr. Powell referenced. One of the probably unintended effects of this history is the bifurcation of physical, quote, from mental health and chemical dependency benefits for the purposes of insurance coverage. There's a wide range in benefit plan design available to us today, but they almost all treat psychiatric disorders as something very different and much more limited than any other kind of health problem. When I shake my head over the fact that we are arguing about this in the year 2003, despite huge advances in the science and technology, I think we may someday look back on these arguments as something like, is the world flat or round? As this kind of discrimination became the community standard, another unintended consequence was put into place. Private insurance benefits were and are so woefully inadequate that those who have had it or have exhausted it, whose families have had it or exhausted it, have found that both the archaic benefit design and the benefit caps have often driven services into other diagnostic categories, or presenting with other kinds of illnesses, or into the public sector. With the explosion in widely available treatment technology, psychopharmacology, far more sophisticated brain research that began in the mid-70s and has been accelerating through the last couple of decades, we have learned far more about how to support people with psychiatric and addictive disabilities in their communities, how effective case management can be, how important stable housing is, how motivating a job can be, etc. All of these services are now or have been an integral part of services typically called community support services. Very few of these services have ever been reimbursable by private insurance. In an instance of what I consider high irony, indigent people who were able to get into comprehensive community support services got far better services and evidence-based services than those whose private benefits limited only to traditional doctor's office appointments. This, in fact, sometimes led parents to send covered children to publicly funded services or to move children out of their houses so they were then eligible for Medicaid or Medicare benefits. But as you know, with the difficulties that the Oregon Health Plan and General Fund are going through in this state, the days when the public sector could take up the slack for private industry are gone, way gone. Outpatient services, both mental health and CD, have been slashed. Medically needy are ineligible at this point for those services. The OHP standard population is ineligible for those services, and the services are extremely limited in the public sector for Medicare only. In the past, the state hospital has taken up the slack for these people. Most of the state hospital beds are closed down now. There is no room at the inn. And that's without referencing cost shifting into the criminal justice system, the education system, and public health system. So I was asked to talk about the dollar offset, but it's almost a moot point at this point. There is no slack in the public sector, and folks that may have been able to access a safety net in the years prior will no longer be able to.
Okay. Thank you. Question?
No, I state, one of these days the science will figure out that Darwin was wrong, too.
It'll
take a while.
Okay. Tim.
Good afternoon, Chairman Morissette, members of the committee. My name is Timothy Hartnett. I'm the executive director of CODA. CODA is Portland's oldest alcohol and drug treatment agency, and I'm here today, obviously, to testify in support of Senate Bill 1. Alcohol and drug abuse are a root cause or contributing factor in virtually every health and social concern Oregonians face. Yet public policy has only just begun to recognize this reality. I guess in baseball parlance, we've really whiffed on this one. It's my view that over our lifetimes, we've really chosen not to give alcohol and drug abuse and mental health sufficient weight and prominence in public policy and healthcare policy. The cost and impact, for example, in alcohol and drug abuse can be readily seen in rising costs in healthcare. You heard a little earlier about mental health and addictions costs. My research indicated that untreated alcohol problems cost this country $184 billion a year in avoidable health care and criminal justice costs. We all know about the problems with traffic fatalities, poor work performance, work-related accidents, divorce, domestic violence estimates, or those cases are at least 50% alcohol and drug-related, crime, no in correction systems. Upwards of 90% of those who are involved in the correction system have alcohol and drug-related problems. Juvenile delinquency, learning disabilities, teen pregnancy, psychiatric illness, child abuse. And I am trying to overwhelm you a little bit with this. And now we have a new one in our lifetime, environmental hazards from crystal methadone labs. Who would have thought 30 years ago that we'd actually be budgeting for things like this? And it gets worse. We know that there is a financial link anyway to terrorism, and I don't mean to play on our current situation, but we do know that Afghanistan is a primary funder of, supporter of heroin to our European allies. So the list is literally endless. Nowhere else in healthcare is public policy so underwhelming given the scale of substance abuse, the cross-cutting nature of the problem, and its impact on public and private dollars. There may not be another single issue in healthcare in which public perception of the problem and public policy lag so far behind the science. People who suffer from alcohol and drug-related problems continue to be perceived of as a group of weak-willed individuals who will only get better when they see and understand the error of their ways. This fundamental stigma represents a critical element in understanding why we have made no meaningful progress in the war on drugs, and why we still have 14 million Americans who are dependent on alcohol. And most importantly, why alcohol and drug abuse treatment is routinely not in health insurance. It's time for public policy to reflect what the American Medical Association and the United States Surgeon General have concluded, that individuals suffering from alcohol and drug-related problems are suffering from a medical condition. The treatment for alcohol and drug abuse is at least as effective as treatments for other chronic conditions. It is one which warrants mandated health insurance coverage that is equal to other medical conditions. We must recognize that alcohol and drug-related disorders are complex medical conditions which are successfully addressed through treatment and prevention rather than merely a moral failing or social problem. Alcohol and drug dependence must be understood more as a brain disease and responded to like other chronic illnesses such as diabetes, hypertension, and asthma, in which treatment is optimized when patients remain in continuing care and are monitored, ideally anyway, without limits or restrictions on the numbers or days of visits covered. Failing to define alcohol and drug abuse as a health problem and provide mandated coverage will only serve to further stigmatize people with alcohol and drug-related problems and continue to drive up costs in other forms of health care and social service. The time is now to support parity for alcohol and drug and mental health disorders. Although the state is faced with the need to cut costs everywhere, addictions cost Oregonians a lot more when left untreated. We spend millions on treatment of alcohol and drug-related hypertension, liver disorders, industrial injuries, and family abuse. Doctors see dramatic numbers of preventable disorders such as hepatitis C, fetal alcohol syndrome, traumatic spinal cord and brain injuries that were all a result of alcohol and drug use. Columbia University has estimated that in 1999, medical expenditures from failure to treat addictions cost $300 billion. The Physician Leadership Council on National Drug Policy recently reported that untreated addiction costs six times more than heart disease, six times more than diabetes, and four times more than cancer. Mandating treatment is not free, but denial of the coverage makes little financial sense. Here at home, our situation is dire. As a result of recent reductions in the Oregon Health Plan and other state budget cuts, the publicly funded alcohol and drug treatment system has experienced dramatic reductions in its capacity, in effect crippling the system. The Oregon Health Plan no longer offers outpatient benefits for its standard population, leaving thousands without treatment, and the residential treatment capacity has been reduced by 24%. In the absence of parity legislation, the publicly funded treatment system will be further overwhelmed by migration of commercially insured patients into its system, in effect leaving government to pick up the tab. Whatever the bills form, I would recommend that careful attention be paid to whether or not annual and lifetime caps are more restrictive than for other diseases. More stringent limits are placed on inpatient or outpatient visits than for other diseases. Arbitrary and undisclosed criteria are used to determine if treatment is medically necessary, and mandated minimum coverage is actually a benefit of real value. I strongly urge you to support an alcohol and drug abuse mental health parity bill. Thanks for your time.
Timothy, your shock and awe testimony was very impressive.
You guys don't look shocked.
I'm awed, and I'm shocked.
I did bring along an article that I wanted to pass along to you.
Well, I was going to suggest that both of you, and we do have your written testimony, and I appreciate that, that you leave written, that you get his written testimony, because I think it's very important that we have that, and I'm impressed with your figures, and I would like to take a look at some of your data, which I assume is all valid, right? Everything you've told. Good.
Actually, most of it, give or take, what's the difference? 80 billion, 170 billion?
No, I've asked some people from corrections to give me some information on drug, alcohol related crimes in incarceration. I mean, if they can make that connection, because I'm interested in the societal cost of drug alcohol treatment, or non-treatment, I guess I should say, in relation to the prison system, the corrections system.
One booking in downtown Portland will pay for a year of outpatient treatment, and that's before anyone touches the court system.
Now, we're talking to someone who does bookings here.
Yeah,
so
I know.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Fisher.
Yeah, I'd like to have you take a look at this. All of the cost indications and stuff here seem to be very, very mild as to how little it takes to pay for this kind of stuff. If that's the case, why so many caps at the 1%, 1.5%?
My opinion is really what I talked about. I think there's been tremendous societal stigma attached to treatment and diagnosis of psychiatric and addictions disorders, and just a historical traditional reluctance to treat them and pay for that kind of treatment, and a very slow recognition of how effective those disorders are and how well researched they are.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
That wasn't my question. I'm not arguing that point. I'm arguing why, if it's so inexpensive, do they bother to put caps on how much the insurance policies can be raised? Mm-hmm. We had a fellow come out here that was supposed to be an actuarial, and he was talking about basically 3-4%, possibly more. I see one cap at 4%. I see one down here where it says they've got a 2% increased cap, and most of them are 1%. To 1.5%. There was one, I think, here where it said they had the 3%. Yeah, I could be wrong. I thought it was
2.5%.
Yeah, but all of these have caps that are less, with the exception of Indiana, which has a 4% cost increase cap. Would Indiana give a cost increase cap that was way, way more than what it actually cost?
You're right, Senator Fisher. The their responses to actuarial reports, and Mr. Bachman, whom you apparently remember, was in good company when he did our Oregon study and estimated about 4%. That was pretty much standard for those actuarial reports, which were the working conditions in which much of this legislation was formulated, because we didn't have experience. What we learned from the experience of states that have reported on the actual cost increases is the actuarial estimates were very conservative, in other words, overestimated the cost. So many of the legislation assumed that being the best we can do, the best guess is the actuarial report, and it is their business to be conservative. Some of the legislation has taken into account that that may be the case and assigned caps based on that. However, those states also have experienced about a 1% increase, some a little more, some a little less, in implementation. So the actuarial reports, we don't need them now. Now we know what happens. A lot of states have a significant experience with this legislation. So we don't. We know the actuaries overestimated the cost and that the actual cost is around 1%. Many of the states that made their tentative and anxious initial steps toward parity have now gone back and expanded the benefits based on their experience.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If that's the case, then why the caps? And how can you have a high increase if you got a cap? I mean, you're setting the caps out there and then going back and saying, hey, they don't exceed the caps, and that we were conservative in estimating 3 or 4%, that it's been less than that. Well, how can it be more than that when they got a cap on it?
It most certainly can't be more than that. It is significantly less than that. It doesn't approach 4%. It's around 1%. So the cap functions in a theoretical sense, but actually the cost difference turned out when the states implemented their laws and saw what happened. When they saw what happened, the difference was about 1%.
Okay.
Because the assumptions of the actuary didn't take into account some things that happen when you treat illnesses appropriately.
Well, Senator Fisher's looking. Senator Minnis had a statement or a question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We'll come back.
Political diatribe. This whole issue is a bit of a conundrum to me, and because there's so many different component parts of the discussion that I think need more attention. A number of years ago, I read a book called Inside the Brain by Kutulak that talks about some of the neuroscience issues and social policy, etc. The conundrum here in my thinking is the self-imposed nature of the thing that we're now labeling a disease. I mean, clearly there's neurotransmitter issues and problems in neurochemistry and whatnot that are interfered with certain types of addictions and so on and so forth and mental illnesses. But when it comes to alcohol and drug, oftentimes you have people who are participating in their own disease, so to speak. So that gets us into this discussion about, getting people into the criminal justice system to force people who apparently don't realize that they have a problem into treatment, et cetera. And at the same time, we have the collapse of the asylums in the United States, where certified smart people with their PhDs and MDs and practices suggested that we ought not put people in large-scale asylums and we needed to have community-based treatment programs, and they trumpeted that. And public policymakers responded by doing away with damaged state hospitals and other facilities, and many people with mental illnesses were dumped into the streets without the appropriate resources. Now we have them in the jails. Help me understand how mental health parity resolves any of those issues. It seems that we really have some structural and, I guess, political.
You certainly do mention some of the big ones. Mental health parity solves the problem of the working individual with private health care insurance being able to get appropriate and timely treatment for his individual illness.
Okay, then help me understand this, because most of the populations we deal with, doctor, are not necessarily in the working
categories.
Because we're talking about people who don't work, won't work, can't work.
That is a different group. This is about supporting people who are working, giving them the appropriate treatment that allows them to continue to work and to pay their insurance premiums so they don't move into the groups you're talking about.
Essentially requiring insurance companies not to discriminate against these illnesses.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I understand that. It just seems that there are a myriad of other problems that are much more severe. For instance, access to mental health treatment for a youth. Mm-hmm. An early diagnosis of mental health issues to youth so that they don't grow in their disorders to the extent that they become a manifest problem for the criminal justice.
That's a huge problem, and one of the things that is part of the findings of the institution of parity in states is that the increase in access to treatment services increases the most in the children of the employed people. So that actually there's actually not that much difference in the adult population because a lot of people don't need that much treatment. It's I mean, what they need is the catastrophic net, but the children get more treatment.
Okay, I'm going to have to end because I have to go next door. It's exactly 3 o'clock. We are going to hear the Mental Health Senate Bill 1 on Thursday. Do any of you plan to be here to answer questions or testify or whatever? But the bill will be heard and questions will be asked, and some of the questions hopefully will be clarified, and the insurance industry will have a prominent role in discussing this bill. So with that, I really appreciate your being here. Thank you very much. We'll close the hearing. We're adjourned.